Hey everyone, ready to dive into something kind of wild? Imagine being able to predict when someone's about to slip up trying to quit smoking.
Sounds futuristic, right?
Totally. But researchers are getting close with this model called M-Risk.
And that's what we're breaking down today.
Yep, their whole research paper.
Yeah.
We're going to figure out how this thing works, what makes it so special, and what it tells us about why people go back to smoking.
The really cool part is we're not just talking about, general risk here. M-Risk is all about zeroing in on those specific moments, like right when someone is most likely to light up.
And that is huge because it could change how we help people quit for good. You know what really blew me away? The research found the highest risk of relapse is actually like an hour before someone picks up a cigarette.
It's true, and that opens a window. If we can catch those high-risk periods, maybe we can interrupt the whole thing that leads to relapse.
Okay, hold up. Before we get into the model itself, let's talk about why quitting smoking is such a struggle in the first place. I mean, everyone knows it's bad for you, but.
Yeah.
Quitting is one of the hardest things a person can do. Even with all the advances we've made in research, relapse rates are still crazy high.
Yeah.
And it's because there are so many triggers, things that can lead someone back to smoking. And they kind of fall into two buckets.
Okay, lay on me.
First, you've got what we call internal stimuli.
Internal.
Like, think stress, anxiety, those cravings, and just feeling like you're out of ways to cope.
It's like your willpower just runs out.
Exactly. Then you have external stimuli. So all the cues around you and in your social life that trigger you.
Okay.
Seeing other people smoke, walking by a store that sells cigarettes, even just being in a place where you used to smoke, those cues are powerful.
So it's like this perfect storm, right? You feel vulnerable inside and tempted from the outside. No wonder it's so hard.
Right. To make interventions that really work, we got to understand those triggers, how they work on their own and how they work together.
Okay, so that brings us to M-Risk. How does this model fit in?
This is where it gets interesting. M-Risk uses mobile sensors, things like wearables, fitness trackers, your phone, to track all kinds of signals that tell us about relapse risk.
You mean like heart rate, location data?
You got it. In this study, they used a chest band to track ECG and respiration to pick up on stress. A wristband with accelerometers and gyroscopes tracked their activity. And of course, the smartphone gave them GPS data for location.
So they're basically getting this full picture of the person, both
And
their
them.
internal state and what's going on around them.
Exactly. And that feeds into M-Risk. It takes that sensor data and uses it to generate a constantly updating risk score.
So you can actually see how likely someone is to have a smoking lapse, like in the near future. I'm picturing a graph, with a line that jumps up and down as the risk changes. Kind of like a heart rate monitor, but for cravings.
That's a great way to visualize it. Now, making a model like that is tricky. The researchers had to deal with some big challenges. Well, for one, sensor data is messy in the real world. People take off their wearables, signals get interrupted. It's not a perfect flow of info.
Yeah, makes sense. Real-world data is never as clean as we wish it was.
Right. And another issue, they had limited data on confirmed smoking lapses. It's hard to capture that exact moment, when someone lights up, especially if they're trying to hide it.
So how do they work around that?
They got creative. They came up with a two-pronged approach. First, they built what they call the DRES model.
Yes.
Yeah, it basically takes that recent sensor data and sums it up using all these cleverly engineered features. It's like squeezing the most relevant info out of, like, a jumbled mess.
So finding the signal in the noise.
Exactly. Then they created the DDHI model, which is all about how the impact of past events fades over time.
Okay, now that one sounds interesting. Tell me more about that.
Well, the DDHI model is built on the fact that what happened in the past, even hours or days ago, can still affect someone's risk.
Yeah.
But that impact lessens as time goes on, so the model factors that in. It uses something called exponential decay functions.
Kind of like ripples in a pond, where the ripples get smaller as they spread out.
Perfect analogy. And here's where it gets even cooler. They also built in something called phenotyping into the DDHI model.
Phenotyping. Now that's a new one.
It's pretty cool. They group people based on how they behaved before quitting. This way, the model can tailor its predictions to each person, like their own tendencies.
So it's like saying, okay, smokers who did this and that before quitting are more likely to relapse this way.
Exactly. That's key to making the model accurate.
This is all impressive, but how did they train this model with such little data on actual lapses? And how do they even know if it was working?
Those are great questions, and that's exactly what we're diving into next. Get ready for positive unlabeled learning.
Okay, so we left off with this big mystery. How do they train this model if they don't have much data on those actual lapses.
It is some pretty clever stuff. Remember, we talked about how hard it is to get those exact smoking moments, right?
Yeah, it's like, how do you catch smoke?
Exactly. So they use this technique. It's called positive unlabeled learning.
Positive unlabeled.
Key U learning, for short.
Key U learning. Okay, I'm listening.
Okay, so think about it like this. You have a bag of marbles. Some are definitely red. Those are your confirmed smoking lapses.
Got it.
But the rest, they could be red or blue. You just don't know. That's your unlabeled data.
So it's a mystery bag. Like, you know there's treasure in there, but you got to figure out which ones are the real gems.
Perfect analogy. PU learning basically helps the model learn the patterns that go with those red marbles, even without knowing exactly which ones in the unlabeled bunch are red, too. They used a specific kind of this. It's called PU bagging. What that means is they train a bunch of different models on different parts of the data and then combine all those predictions.
So it's like getting a bunch of expert opinions and then using all that info to decide.
Exactly. Now, the next problem, they didn't have confirmed negative labels. So those times when someone is definitely not about to smoke.
Right, because it's hard to prove a negative. Like, you can't follow someone around all day and write down every time they don't smoke.
Exactly. So to deal with that, they created a new loss function. It's called the rare positive loss function.
Loss function.
RP loss function.
RP, okay. Still not sure I get that.
Imagine you're training a dog to find truffles.
Okay.
The loss function is like the feedback you give the dog. If it digs in the wrong spot, you say, nope, not there. If it finds a truffle, you give it a treat, you praise it. The RP loss function, this is specifically for those situations where the truffles, those smoking lapses, are rare.
It's like telling the model, hey, those relapse moments, that's the good stuff. Focus on that.
Exactly. The RP loss function basically teaches the model to group those positive cases together while knowing there are probably a lot more negative ones hidden in that unlabeled data.
Okay, so PU learning, that helps them train the model with that limited positive data. The RP loss function helps it hone in on those rare moments. But how do they know it was working? How do you measure success with this?
Great question. They couldn't use those typical metrics, things like F1 score or AUOC, because they didn't have those clear negative labels. So they came up with something new. It's called the intervention hit rate, or IHR.
Intervention hit rate.
IHR.
IHR. All right. What's that about?
Okay. Picture this. You can step in right before someone is about to slip up. That's a hit. The IHR measures like what percentage of lapses you could actually intervene on successfully.
So the higher the IHR, the better the model is at predicting those, like those critical moments.
Exactly. And they got some really good results. The model got to an 85% IHR with only 5.5 potential interventions a day.
Wow. 85%.
Yeah.
So that means potentially you could prevent almost 9 out of 10 relapses with just a handful of interventions a day.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It is. And remember that thing we talked about earlier, the risk peaking about an hour before a lapse? Well, the model, on average, found the high risk time about 32 minutes before a lapse, so there's still plenty of time for intervention.
This is blowing my mind. But what is it picking up on? What makes that risk spike?
Ah, that's the big question. To figure out what's going on under the hood, they used a technique called SHP.
S-H-A-P.
Yeah.
Sounds intense.
Yeah.
But I have no idea what that is.
It stands for Shapley Additive Explanations. It's a way to figure out which features are contributing most to the model's predictions. Like, imagine trying to figure out which players on a basketball team are making the biggest difference to winning the game.
So it's finding the relapse risk MVPs.
Exactly. And when they used SHAP on the M-Risk model, some interesting stuff came out. Remember those three types of sensor data? Stress, location, and activity.
Yeah, they were trying to get, like, the whole picture of what the person was experiencing.
Well, it turns out, visiting places where they used to smoke, especially those from the pre-quit phase, that was one of the strongest things predicting a lapse.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Those environmental cues, they can be so powerful.
Here's one that might surprise you. Being physically active was also linked to relapse risk.
Really? That's weird. I would think exercise would help people resist cravings.
It seems that way, but it might be that more activity means they run into more of those smoking cues out in the world. Or maybe there's a psychological thing where people feel like they've earned a cigarette after working out.
Like the I deserve this mentality.
Exactly.
So it's not just about willpower. It's about those sneaky environmental and behavioral cues that we might not even realize.
Exactly. And we can't forget about stress. The model showed a bunch of stress-related things as predictors of relapse risk, like how much stress throughout the day, how concentrated recent stress is, even something called the skewness of stress likelihood.
Hold on, skewness. What does that even mean when we're talking about stress?
Think of it like this. If you're plotting your stress levels on a graph, skewness tells you if the graph is leaning more towards those high-stress moments or those low-stress moments. And it turns out that unevenness, whether you have more high-stress peaks than valleys, it can actually predict relapse risk.
So it's not just how stressed you are overall, it's the pattern of your stress throughout the day.
You got it. This shows just how much we can learn from looking at these patterns in sensor data.
This is all mind-blowing stuff. But where do we go from here? What are the implications of all this?
That's a great question, and one we'll dive into in the final part of our deep dive. We'll explore how MRISC and models like it can revolutionize smoking cessation interventions, and maybe open up a whole new world for helping people break free from addiction. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. We've been on this wild ride with the MRISC model, learning how it can predict when someone's about to, you know, crave a cigarette.
It's been quite the journey. We've learned some incredible things about how tough quitting smoking is and how powerful those little mobile sensors are.
It really makes you think. All that info from the stuff we carry around in our pockets. But what does it all mean for people trying to quit? How can this research actually help?
This is where it gets exciting. MRISC and models like it could change everything about how we help people stop smoking.
So no more, like, handing out generic pamphlets.
Not even close. Imagine knowing those risky moments in real time, right? And then using that to give someone support right when they need it most.
So instead of one size fits all, it's like a plan built just for you based on what makes you tick and what your triggers are.
Exactly. It could be something as simple as sending a notification right then, like a distraction, or reminding them of a coping strategy that's worked before.
It's like having a coach in your pocket, 24/7, ready to help when things get tough.
That's a great way to think about it. And the cool thing is, this tech, it can learn over time. It gets better at predicting and preventing those lapses as it gets more data about you, how you behave, how you respond to different things.
So it's not just about reacting after a slip-up. It's about seeing it coming and heading it off.
Precisely. And that can make a huge difference in helping people quit for good.
Okay, this is going to sound a little out there, but if we can predict smoking lapses like this, what other things could we predict? You know, could we use this for other behaviors?
Now that's a question I love. If it works for smoking, why not for other things, like overeating or how much someone drinks, even relapse for other addictions?
It's like we're opening up this whole new world of, like, personalized behavior change.
It is. It's super exciting. But of course, we got to be careful. You know, there are ethical things to think about.
Right. We can't forget about privacy and people's right to choose for themselves.
Absolutely. As this technology gets better, we need to have those tough conversations about how to use it the right way.
It's a powerful tool. And like they say, with great power comes great responsibility.
Well said. This research shows what's possible when we use AI and mobile tech to help people, to help them make positive changes in their lives. But it's important to remember, tech is only part of it. Human behavior is complicated. And to help someone, you need a whole person approach.
So it's not just about the tech. It's about understanding the person, their motivations, their struggles.
Exactly. Meeting people where they're at and giving them the support they need when they need it.
Well, this has been really inspiring. I'm excited about what this research could lead to.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's a glimpse into a future where tech can help people live healthier, happier lives.
And to our listeners, if you're trying to quit smoking, don't give up hope. There's help out there. Don't be afraid to reach out. You're not alone in this.
And remember, every step you take towards being smoke-free is a win. Celebrate those victories.
That's it for today, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Until next time.